We are heading into perhaps the most consequential local election in recent memory. Forecasters are expecting big gains for Reform and the Lib Dems and a bad showing for Labour and the Tories. Could we be looking at the end of the two-party system? To make sense of what comes next, please do come along to our local elections shake-up event. Join the Spectators panel and special guests Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg and Zia Yusuf as they analyse the results on the 7th of May at the Emmanuel Centre in Westminster. For tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/local-elections-live.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor. On this week's podcast, we ask, is Garden Court Chambers home to Britain's most radical lawyers? Should we care about the Dubaiification of London? And what motivates people who are still obsessed with Princess Diana?
First up, Garden Court Chambers in Lincoln's Inn Fields has a reassuringly traditional facade. Yet, writes Ross Clark in his cover piece for the magazine this week, the facade is just that. For behind the Georgian windows, there operates arguably the most radically effective cell of left-wing activists in Britain. From defending vandalism on ideological grounds to preventing convicted criminals from being deported, the cases taken on by Garden Court lawyers raise questions about impartiality. Is this just another example of laws expanding empire over the domain of elected politicians? The Spectator's editor and former Justice Secretary, Michael Gove, joined the podcast to discuss. I started by asking Michael to take listeners through some of the examples of cases taken on by Garden Court lawyers.
Yes, so you sometimes hear the phrase lefty lawyer or activist lawyer flung around. And of course, barristers traditionally object to that because they say, look, the cab rank principle applies. You mustn't confuse me with my client. Everyone deserves effective legal representation. And just because I happen to be arguing for this particular foreign criminal to stay in the country, please don't think that I in any way should be conflated with a broader argument about asylum or immigration. But the striking thing about Garden Court Chambers is that they invariably find themselves acting for criminals who want to stay in this country. Some of the people who are also acting for those criminals sit as judges in some of the tribunals which decide on these cases, and some of them have been more than explicit about what their political views are, for example, saying that steps to control migration are wrong. But it's not just in those cases. It's also the case that there's a Garden Court lawyer, Frank McGuinness, who is acting pro bono for Hamas. Mr. McGuinness, clearly a gifted advocate, is also someone who is a proud communist, who's recently expressed full solidarity with the Irish Republican band Kneecap. And he's not an isolated figure in terms of energetic political activism, because Garden Court have also been active in defending climate change protesters, arguing that criminal damage can be justified because of the greater ideology behind it. And they've also secured a landmark victory at the European Court of Human Rights against the government of Switzerland. A group of Swiss pensioners wanted to take their country to court on the basis that Switzerland had been inadequately energetic in upholding net zero policies, and therefore their right to family life was put at risk because they couldn't go outside in a heat wave. Now, you might think that this was a case that should have been laughed out of court, but Garden Court succeeded in winning that case and used the ECHR to overturn Switzerland's democratically elected government's policy. So that's just a snapshot of some of the causes that they've picked up. And you would also look in vain, I think it's fair to say, for any Garden Court barrister who is acting either for Border Force or for the Israeli government.
So are you suggesting that there are questions about impartiality that need to be asked then?
Well, again, one has to be careful. One always has to be careful when discussing lawyers. But I think it's pretty fair to say that in Garden Court Chambers, there are probably unlikely to be many barristers who are card-carrying members of the Conservative Party who'll be voting Reform in the local elections, or who are eager Spectator subscribers. though you never know. But it is the case that the overwhelming flavour, vibe, as you might put it, of Garden Court is radical. And, you know, they have a special team to defend protesters. They also have a housing team. The housing rights team is led by, again, a very eminent barrister, Liz Davis, briefly led a Trotskyist group called the Socialist Alliance. No one disputes the fact that she's a formidable lawyer, but a flavour of the broader views of the housing team can also be discerned from one of her protégés, a chap called Nick Banner, who's written a book called Against Landlords, and he has a number of novel recommendations in the book, including 100% capital gains tax on all domestic property, and he's explicit in saying that his principal intellectual influence is Das Kapital.
Yes, and driving landlords from the face of the earth as well.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I mean, he's got great rhetorical style.
Yes, clearly. There was, you mentioned just now, and Ross says in his piece, there's this example, which I think is quite extraordinary because it's a bit of a landmark ruling. But that case in Switzerland where the arguments put forward by Garden Court won the favour of the ECHR, who ruled against the democratically elected Swiss government. And one of the things that Ross says in the piece is that there's a kind of main tool used by Garden Court barristers, which is an inventive interpretation of the right to a family life. Do you think that this case specifically and Garden Court cases perhaps more generally, do they strengthen the case for leaving the ECHR?
I think they probably do. Though the ECHR has been depicted as a living instrument. But a couple of weeks ago, we had a very good piece by Peter Lilly, former cabinet minister, outlining that when the ECHR was established, it was a Labour Lord Chancellor who said, the way in which these rights can be interpreted could be elastic in a way which undermines some of the democratic and indeed legal principles of the British system. As you look at it as a text, the principles in the ECHR are those which very few people would argue with as, you know, embodiments of admirable principles by which a democracy should operate. But what's really striking is the way in which this living instrument, and in particular the right to family life, has been used. So one Garden Court barrister has argued that a particular criminal should remain in the country because he's formed a relationship with his stepson, who's 15, and that relationship could not be sustained over Zoom, and so therefore he has to stay here. And I think that it's the right to family life in particular, which has cropped up again and again as the instrument, as Ross quite rightly points out, that has been used to expand both the way in which the ECHR operates and to keep people in this country whose presence here many might not consider to be conducive to the public good. And I think that only reinforces that case. At the very, very least, I think the point made by the Labour MP, Jonathan Hinder, this week at a Civic Forum event, that the public won't put up with membership of the ECHR if it prevents us controlling our borders, I think that is definitely the case.
So yes, that comment about the public not putting up with the ECHR, what do you think the solution is here to this scenario that Ross describes in his piece, this scenario whereby, to quote Lord Sumption, who also features, that we're seeing law's ever-expanding empire over the domain of elected politicians? I mean, what needs to be done about this? Is it something Parliament needs to deal with?
Well, I do think that Parliament should reassert itself. And it is striking that now the logical thing to do if you are a left-wing activist, passionate, idealistic, talented, is not to run the risk of going into Parliament, where asking a stooge question at PMQs might be the highlight of your week, but rather to join Garden Court chambers, where you can actually change the law through the courts rather than through the tedious process of winning an election, winning arguments and winning votes. I certainly think that the rule of law is a precious thing and that we should respect courts' judgments. But if we're going to continue to have the respect for the rule of law that's been so important in our history, then we need to recognise that that needs to be balanced with the fact that The real Supreme Court in this country is the High Court of Parliament, and it is the democratically elected representatives who should be able to lay down the law literally when it comes to such things as how we protect our borders, or indeed what the right balance is between the freedom to protest and the right to protect private property.
But Michael, if you do support the rule of law, as you say, I mean, surely one could make the defence of Garden Court Chambers here, saying that they are representing, yes, often some pretty reprehensible individuals, but those people do have the right for a free trial. And would you not want a Garden Court Chambers barrister on your side if you were ever falling foul of the law?
I think that if I rang up Garden Court, or my solicitor did, and asked for a brief there, I think they might find themselves unavailable. I think it might be a bit like a taxi driver saying, I'm not going to go south of the river at this time of night, mate. I don't know. I might have to put it to the test. But you're absolutely right. The principle that everyone deserves legal representation is a fair one. But Ross lays out the evidence. And in the court of public opinion, that is the spectator readership, people can decide for themselves whether or not the cab rank principle is really being observed as it might be by Garden Court.
Michael, thank you very much indeed for joining.
Pleasure, Will. Thank you.
Will, what else did you enjoy this week?
I really loved an interview by Philip Patrick in this week's magazine, in which he's managed to track down and interview Japan's last ninja. He's 76 years old now, and he is the last person in the country trained in the traditional arts of the ninja. And since he has not decided to take on an apprentice, this means that this ancient profession will die with him. So it's a bit of a different type of interview, but I strongly recommend it to listeners. How about you, Lara? What did you like?
Well, I'm going to go for Katrina Olding's Still Life column in the back of the book this week. Katrina has been in New York and DC visiting her youngest daughter, and she takes us through her trip. She's been to the National Gallery. She enjoys a dry martini that she says was perfect, so large it had a horizon, and she's been to the Blue Ridge Mountains. And the whole piece culminates in this rather dramatic chase to try and retrieve her laptop, which she managed to leave behind. I think we can hear an extract from Katrina now.
People I met, while acknowledging that change was necessary, were embarrassed by their president and worried about what he'd say or do next. Kathy works 14-hour days and really gets out. On the first evening, we asked two well-padded men seated at a waterfront restaurant in Georgetown what the food was like. In heavy accents, they said it was good. They told us they were Russian and in town for a meeting with your leader. Afterwards, noticing Kathy's clenched jaw, I said, they look more like the Russian football hooligans who rioted before the last England game in Marseille than politicos. The table behind us was loud, southern voices. Kathy thought she recognised a congresswoman from Louisiana. We tried to eavesdrop, but could hear little above the laughter, which sounded four big drinks down and a bit hysterical. The following day, my daughter and I went to the National Gallery. We both paint professionally and repeatedly got a row from a disembodied voice for standing too close to the pictures. Inspired and culturally sated after 3 hours of gazing at paintings, we headed to the old Ebbett Grill near the White House for a dry martini and a snack. My daughter was, by chance rather than intention, wearing a denim jacket from her student days with a large Looney Tunes logo on the back, which she hid with her long red blonde hair. As dry martinis go, this one was perfect, so large it had a horizon.
And listeners might also be interested to know that if you'd like to hear more from Katrina Olding, and indeed from our features editor Will Moore, they will be together at the Spectator Writers' Dinner on the 19th of June. You can book it by going to spectator.co.uk/tastings. Next up, is London becoming like Dubai? From its gloopy green-filled chocolate to its soulless towers, Dubai is exerting a cultural influence over our capital, writes Angus Colwell in the magazine this week. More and more young people are moving to the city in the United Arab Emirates, but now it appears that Dubai culture is being imported back into London. Chocolate from the Emirate has become a social media phenomenon and is relatively expensive, although some people claim it's delicious. To help us make sense of what's been going on, Angus joined the podcast, along with the writer Louise Perry, who also recently wrote for The Spectator about the phenomenon of young people from Britain moving to Dubai. I started by asking Angus to explain the obsession with Dubai chocolate.
I think I noticed about maybe 3 weeks ago, you'd go into the front of an off-license and you'd just see right at the front of the cashier, Dubai chocolate. And I sort of thought, okay, that seems a bit strange. It sort of like seemed quite naff. And then I saw lots of stuff online about how expensive it was. It was about £7 or £8. And I read about it a bit more, and it's been causing like global pistachio shortages. And so eventually for the piece, I decided to very kindly on the Spectator's expenses, pick up a bar from St. James Park Tube Station. And it's this kind of like quite gloopy chocolate filled with pistachio and sort of carrier and this sort of green mulch, which you can imagine it being tasty if it wasn't warm and out of St. James's Park Station. But the experience wasn't lovely.
And you say in your piece that this chocolate is a symptom of a wider Dubaiification of the capital. What are you noticing here that you think is part of a trend?
Yeah, so I think there was a lot of stuff about 10 years ago, and I mentioned this in the piece, about skyscrapers sort of making the Dubaiification of London, etc. What's happening now is more in the cultural realm, where a lot of young people on TikTok are following Dubai-based influencers. In the same way that in the 90s, the main cultural influence on London was America and New York, and everyone wanted to wear Ralph Lauren and everything like that. Now there are Dubai-based influencers who film themselves in their car eating Dubai chocolate. And sort of like, it's this strange sort of, it's not sort of Middle Eastern culture necessarily. It's not Arabic culture. This is not sort of the Arabic culture that's come to London, whether it be on Green Lanes or the Edgware Road over the past couple of years. It's a very strange sort of hyper-consumerist, lowest common denominator sort of visual medium of like pistachio, chocolate, and everything is glitzy. And if you go around Knightsbridge, I think you'll start to see what I mean.
Louise, you've written about more and more young people moving to Dubai, and it's indeed estimated that around 250,000 Brits are living in the Emirate. Why do you think it's so popular, and do you agree that Dubai is now starting to influence London's culture?
I think it has, but then I agree with Angus that it's not Arab culture as such, right? It's what Dubai culture consists of is almost like the free market run completely amok in global culture. So it's taken all of the features of every global culture that are most attractive in a quite a lowest common denominator way. I mean, when we went to Dubai Airport as a family recently, when we were on holiday there, we had our baby in a sling, like a forward-facing sling, and he found Dubai Airport just overwhelmingly magical. It was like, you remember in A Bug's Life when Flick goes to Bug City for the first time and he's like overwhelmed by the sights and sounds of it. Was like that. And it did force me to conclude that in a way what Dubai culture is appealing to is someone with about the attention span of a baby. It's like very, very very, very sort of base but clearly attractive. You know, it's very glitzy, it's very exciting. I mean, a friend of mine said slightly unkindly of Dubai culture having been there, that it's sort of like what paradise feels like if your parents didn't have indoor plumbing, right? It's luxurious in a really tacky way, you know. And I say this with the full recognition that Dubai, for a lot of young British professionals right now, is infinitely more attractive than living in Britain. So it's not just 250,000 people in Dubai. We've also got 250,000 British people in nearby Abu Dhabi. So the Gulf at the moment is doing an incredible job of attracting young British people. And this is despite the fact that it is tacky, right? But the key advantages are there's very, very low tax. There's very, very low crime. You can live a much more luxurious life. And I don't just mean the tacky bits of luxury. I mean that you can have more money to spend on education for your children, more money to spend on domestic help to make family life easier. You know, you can completely see why it's so attractive to people. And now it's got branches of Waitrose, which we visited while we were there, which was a slightly surreal experience. And
So it's not just British people moving there. There are elements of British culture going there too, such as Waitrose.
Such as Waitrose. I mean, I always think this whenever you're in international hotels, the bits of English culture that people in other countries like are like the by appointment to the Queen jam kind of culture. You know, it's the elements of posh heritage culture which people love. They're not actually interested in the stuff that tends to be promoted by the British government as the most noteworthy elements of British culture. So you have all of that in Dubai. You have Waitrose, you have fancy British brands, you can buy as much Burberry and Harrods stuff as you like. Again, it's these elements of international culture which have outcompeted the others, all find their home in Dubai.
Angus, in your piece, you at the end visit a bit of Kensington and you talk to various people about Dubaiification. What did you glean from that?
Well, I gleaned from that, sort of similar to what Louise is saying, is that I spoke to some couples who were sat outside of Leto Cafe and the Prada Cafe, which are very glitzy and sell ice cream for £11. and several of them had been to Dubai. None of them were from Dubai. And asked them if they thought London was becoming more like Dubai. And they said, yes, a little bit. But none of them wanted to for it to go all the way. You know, they pointed, several of them pointed to me at Harrah's, which is a sort of beautiful Edwardian building. I think this is what we're sort of maybe losing sight of. There's nothing, you know, I would love to visit Dubai. I think it would be fascinating.
It's the same as... Dubai?
Probably not. Yeah. But, but, you know, I find it fascinating. But I think what the jarring thing is that London, its advantage is that it's one of the least planned, most organically developed cities. There is no, like, unique architectural style. There's no New York style grid. You know, there is, it's this, like, pleasingly chaotic place that's evolved over hundreds of years. Dubai, it's sort of, it was a blank slate about 70 years ago. It's entirely sort of artificially constructed in many ways, and that is fascinating and interesting. But it does mean that it sort of really jars up against London. And then, yeah, as I say, when I speak to those couples, the things that they, you know, liked were the Edwardian buildings. Ultimately, they may be at the Prada Cafe, which is selling sort of green coffees for 15 quid, but they're also outside Harrods. And, you know, everyone knows the architecture of Knightsbridge. It looks quintessentially London.
So if you were to pass your own judgment on Dubaiification, good thing, bad thing, mix of both?
I don't think it will last, because I don't think it has the sort of cultural legs to still be it. Because, as Louise says, because it is such a visual medium for the attention span of the baby, there'll be a new thing that comes along in sort of 5 years, and it doesn't have sort of cultural longevity. I find it fascinating. I don't want much more of it, though.
You've reached the limit.
Yeah.
Okay. Like Dubai chocolate, I imagine. And Louise, would you ever consider moving to Dubai?
No. I concluded from being there that actually the delights of not paying income tax are outweighed by the sense of the uncanny which the place solicits in me. And clearly some people are more tolerant of that than others. And you can definitely form a kind of carefully curated life for yourself within Dubai, where you are mostly interacting with other British people and you can sort of pretend that you're not actually in the middle of the desert. So I can see why so many people are willing to make a life for themselves in Dubai. Whether or not they stay, I don't know. I mean, we don't really have great numbers on anything to do with British immigration and immigration. And that includes how many people are going to these places, how many of them stay. I've read that the schools are now retaining students for longer than they used to, which does suggest that maybe more people are permanently settling there. But really what they're doing is they're just attracting people with the tax regime. And if other countries cottoned on to low tax, low crime, they would presumably be attracting people for the same reasons. It's not that Dubai has anything essential to it, which is really attractive. It's more that they basically made some good governance decisions, which could be imitated elsewhere.
Louise and Angus, thank you both very much indeed for joining us.
And finally, almost 30 years on from her death, why has a fascination with Princess Diana endured? In the book section of the magazine this week, the writer and academic Philip Hensher reviews Diana World, An Obsession, a new book by Edward White, which focuses more on the effect that Diana had on people rather than her as a person. So why do people feel such a connection to Diana, and does she still cast a shadow on the monarchy today? Philip joined the podcast alongside the journalist and royal commentator Angela Levin. Given Diana is such a studied subject, I started by asking Philip what he learnt that was new from the book.
Well, I think that we have to accept at this distance in time that we didn't, for the most part, know Diana Wales, and we don't really know what she was like as a human being. And the real proper subject of interest is how people reacted to their idea of Diana Wales. I know that sounds a bit kind of Pomo and all the rest of it, but I don't see any way around that. And he does explore all sorts of extraordinary areas. He goes very strongly into, for instance, the impact of Diana's reputation on the Muslim world. And he talks quite seriously about the people who wrote about Diana in her lifetime, the journalists, and also the kind of huge rise in number of biographers. I think all that is extremely interesting. This is actually the first really good book I've read about Diana Wales, and I think he really deserves a medal for having read a lot of very, very bad books about her.
Angela, on the subject of that distance in time that Philip just mentioned there, why do you think it is that Diana has endured as such a popular subject, and why is it that people even now
still love her as much as they do. I mean, you must have met your fair share of Diana superfans over the years.
Yeah, not only did I met the superfans, but I met the woman herself. And she knocked me for six. Now, as a journalist, I'm quite sort of, you know, hard-nosed. And I remember it at, she'd invited various chefs to come, each one person to do make it tasty. And I went along, and she was stunningly beautiful. Her blue eyes, her charm, the way she could actually talk to you, that you would give in to her very easily. And I found that that was extraordinary. And I think that people have hung on to that because she was such a beautiful girl. And she went through such a lot, a terrible childhood, and then a very unhappy marriage. And yet she was smiling and she did look after people and she did lots of things that nobody at that time would, you know, like shaking hands with someone who had HIV and AIDS and all those things. And I think that people loved her for that. And she was exceptionally beautiful. And I think that people actually often prefer people quite a long time after they die than actually when they're alive. I think there's something where we get romantic about it. And I think people do think that she was wonderful. She was very popular in America just as much as she was in the UK. And even around the world, people adored her. And even if she did wrong things, she was forgiven because she just got away with it. It's very interesting, actually. And I think that was one of the things that was so marvellous about her, that she could, with a smile, make you give in, even to a hard old journalist. She just had that knack.
Philip, you talk in your piece about the shift of imaginative energy in our culture that took place during her life and also posthumously. What do you mean by that?
Well, firstly, I have to, if I were Edward White's spokesman here, I would actually pick Angela up on a couple of points. And Edward White does point out that there were, you know, other people who were making a big thing about engaging with AIDS patients at the time. And Princess Margaret, for instance, who you don't think of in this condition, she actually opened the London Lighthouse, you know. So I think that there is a certain amount of attachment to Diana as a kind of beautiful figure. Whether she sort of became the ideal of beauty because she was Princess of Wales is another interesting question. I mean, there's quite a lot of evidence that Edward White goes into that when she was first engaged to the Prince of Wales, she wasn't regarded as outstandingly beautiful. It was really kind of the shift of the aesthetic standard moved in her direction because she was Princess of Wales. That's what Edward White comes quite close to arguing. Now, on the kind of passive victimhood thing, I do think that, you know, I mean, Diana's death and her last years was such a kind of colossal imaginative event. The communal imagination just ran on, you know, these poor people that just are just going to be saved by Diana descending. They can't do anything about their circumstances. And I do think that that has fed into an increase in culture in the last couple of decades, where we don't imagine, you know, what can we do to, you know, to invent our lives, to create new things, but rather, well, why don't we just kind of accept that that we can't do anything about our circumstances? We're just going to wait here for, ideally, a kindly princess to descend and bless us. Or alternatively, if that doesn't work out, let's sign on the doll as one of the millions suffering with anxiety. You know, I do think that there has been a big shift in this country towards celebration of passive victimhood. And I think that, you know, Diana, the cult of Diana isn't the whole of it, but I think it plays a significant part.
Angela, I'd love to ask you about your opinion on the common imagination, as Philip just phrased it there, around Diana, particularly after her death. I'm thinking especially here of people like Christopher Hitchens, who argued for many years that there was a sort of collective national hysteria after her death, and the sort of tragedy of her death. The reaction to the tragedy of her death went overboard. What do you make of arguments like that?
Yeah, I think that's right, actually. People believe that after her death, people then started going with lots of flowers. People didn't used to do that very much, one or two. But actually, I was working opposite the park, and it went up every day by mountains of what the smell was and what was there. And people were just going and crying. One day, no, people didn't say anything. One day they were crying. And it was just hysterical. Mm. But they wanted to do it because they felt that they owned her partly. I mean, that's why she was called the People's Princess, because they felt they were part of it. They loved her, and they felt very much that without her, it was going to be terrible. And of course it wasn't, because, you know, life goes on and the royal family goes on. But I think it is very powerful that people felt that she should not have gone at such an early age, which is actually understandable. I think the mood of the country at that time was actually to cry and weep and to let all their emotions come out, actually.
How does the book deal with that particular period, Philip, in terms of that emotional outburst?
Well, it very usefully reminds us of what a previous editor of this magazine said, and called it Boris called it a Latin American festival of grief. And I think a lot of us did feel that there was something new and foreign about these spectacles of grief in 1997. He demonstrates very convincingly that no one laid flowers at the site of accidents until 1985 in this country. Mm. It was reported on in 1985 as a strange new phenomenon.
Is this an American import?
I don't think so. I think it's actually a one from Roman Catholic countries, but I don't think I think it's difficult to be certain about these things. I do think that something that became very apparent quite quickly was that the kind of recreational grievers, the people who, you know, who turned up and sobbed and then went away again and got on with their lives after a week, they were sort of treading on the lives of people who had a genuine personal reason to grieve, actually. And I think that anyone who looks at it must feel very deeply for Diana's family, and also for the royal family that she went into. And I think there's a kind of fundamental lack of propriety there, that, and you simply were not, and I think in many quarters you still are not allowed to say, what propriety is there for crying like this over someone who wouldn't have given you the time of day in real life? It really shocked me. I think partly it shocked me because I was away for that. I was away in Italy for that week, and so the strangeness of it just hit me very, very hard.
I wrote a biography of Prince Harry, and what he said to me was that he was so angry by the people crying down the roads as the went through, as they walked down. And he said, you know, how dare they cry? This is to me, how dare they cry? It's not their loss, it's our loss. How can they take that away? They don't know her. I know her. So he was in a real state with that. And actually, it was me who he said for the first time that it was absolutely cruel to have him walking behind his mother's death. But that was very, very important to him. And he said some of them grabbed him by the arm and hugged him with the wetness on their face. It really, really upset him. It was not just his mother dying, but other people taking the feeling away that this was my mother. Very interesting, I think. You're absolutely right.
And just finally, do you think that the royals have now moved on from the post-Diana period, or do you think it's left an indelible mark on the monarchy, one which is perhaps particularly felt by the current female members of the monarchy?
That's a very interesting question. I think it's both, isn't it? I mean, sometimes Diana's ability overrides anything that's going on, and sometimes people are moving forward. But I think for the children and the fact that Prince William looks so much like his mother, that stays there forever, I think. And I think it's a mixture. It depends what's going on. But I think we all feel very much for her because we felt we could reach her. And I think before that, you couldn't reach a royal family. It would be very distant. They might say hello, good morning, and that would be it. I had to come far. But with Diana, there was warmth and compassion. And I think that that still stays with us.
I do want to say that the king is a wonderfully warm human being. And I just want to share that two or three years ago, I was just sitting outside my local Gales in Clapham, and along comes the king and queen on a visit to Clapham. And he stopped and he had a conversation with me about cheese straws. And he entered into this with such kind of warmth and excitement. I think the king gave me the impression that there was nowhere in the world he would rather be than in Clapham and talking to me. And I think that's a gift, and you can't fake it.
Angela and Philip, thank you both very much indeed for joining us. And that's it for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, please pick up a copy of the magazine to read all the articles we talked about in full. And if you do enjoy the podcast, why not click the follow button to be notified when a new episode is out? I'm William Moore.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, and we hope you join us again next week.